persists through China and Japan. He identifies them as Hinayanist and Mahayanist, you know? So a qualitative distinction between them there, between great vehicle and lesser vehicle. And then when you get down to 6, 7, and 8, they're all Mahayanist, but in the last 6 and 7, this distinction, sub-distinction of the one Buddha vehicle, which seems to supersede the Mahayana, appears. And then you get down to 8, where esoteric Buddhism appears. And then you get down to the supplement, where he's not listing them as 8 sects yet, but here are 2 newcomers, Achan or Zen and Pure Land, originally out of China, but then developing very differently and quickly in Japan. Okay? So something's going on here. Now, Gyonin professes in his text that there is no particular qualitative order by which he's listing this. You know, swears up and down that that's the case. That it's just a convenient structure in which to work through this material, and there's no particular significance in this arrangement. But it's rather interesting that one of the editors of the earliest 20th century Japanese reprint of Gyonin says the following outright. He says, though Gyonin professes that the sects are listed according to no particular order, order is most definitely detected in his arrangement. Isn't that interesting? So this is the way people were reading the text. And indeed, it's been observed that the 8 sects are in Gyonin's text are arranged according to something called the 10 mentalities or perspectives, which is a normative schematic for doctrinal classification of the different Buddhist teachings, which begin with shallow and move to profound. They begin with Hinayana and end up with the one Buddha vehicle and esoteric Buddhism, and suggest a kind of progressive historical refinement of Buddhist teachings, a kind of evolving out of earlier and more primitive forms of Buddhism, higher, deeper, more pure form, you know, resonance of the Buddha's message to the highest levels of the Buddhist teaching and what its true intention was. So there's a kind of soteriological sweep to these as well. So expedient, elementary, then progresses to advanced or true. India to Japan, the geographical spectrum. Era of the Buddha to Heian and Kamakura. Can you see what's going on here? You know, we're getting a qualitative stacking of Buddhist traditions according to degree of expediency and reality or truth, and then that's being spread across a geography of India, China, Japan, and historical progress down to the Kamakura period of Japan. Okay? The Short History of the 12 Sects by Nanjo uses the same structure as Gyonin's text. Hierarchical classification purports to be replaced with a neutral historical framework of ancient, medieval, and modern. Modern here being 13th century Japan, Kamakura Japan. But hints of teleological trajectory and hierarchy remain. Jodo Shin and Nichiren schools, which are added to the list here, are the last culminating sects listed in this sweep. Okay? And although they claim, and they, in their chapters, are presented as claiming historical primacy over the other schools. So, past and present, as the predestined fulfillment of a progressive revelatory unfolding of the Buddha's teaching. So, Nichiren, what is it saying here? Nichiren tradition in Japan and the Jodo Shin tradition, or Pure Land, true Pure Land tradition in Japan, were actually representing themselves as being a preordained, predestined, and even foretold revelatory culmination of Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching. So that Shakyamuni Buddha was not preaching the core scriptures, foundational scriptures of these texts for people of his age, but preaching these texts and their message for people thousands of years later, where circumstances will have completely changed and the world was on a transitional, you know, watershed between, you know, the previous eras and a new era. So it was an era when foregoing traditions of Buddhism that had prevailed in earlier periods were rendered obsolete and in effect abrogated by the messages of the Nichiren and Pure Land schools. And according to the Nichiren and Pure Land schools in the more radical forms, where was this to take place? Can anybody answer that question? Japan. When was it to take place? 13th century, 12th and 13th century Japan, when these schools came on the scene. When was Galen's text written? 13th century Japan. When is the modern period? 13th century Japan. You see what's going on here? So you can pick it up here. It's easy to understand, see these as texts that, as a representation of Buddhist history, as an evolution that corresponds to the sweep from primitive societies to modern society. And then in fact, the Buddhism that would emerge with Nichiren school and Jodo Shin schools during this period of time was a Buddhism destined for modernity. Okay? Rational, scientific, universal. Zen got on the bandwagon too. If you ever have a chance to read D.T. Suzuki's Introduction to Zen, Zen is presented quintessentially as the ur-mysticism. It basically taps into the common elemental religious experience behind every inspired religion, which Suzuki calls the mystical experience, yet has the added benefit that it's not overly intellectualized, as Buddhism was in India, that it isn't turned over to a bunch of bureaucrats and painstaking bean counters and doctrine analysis, as Chinese did in China, but comes to the Japanese people who are simple, poetic, natural, and in coming into contact with Zen, bring out its true and profound message as a disciplined rational mysticism, if you have to figure that one out, a mysticism that's not capricious, but that can be inculcated by cultivation and therefore spread to humankind as a universal religion. Same story, okay? Where do Chinese fit into this scheme? They've still got Buddhist. Buddhist tradition disappeared out of India long ago, but where does this leave Chinese Buddhists? Of whom any number were good friends of Nanjo Bunyo and other scholars. Well, the issue here is, you know, well, they're in China to begin with, so it's not Japan, tough luck. But they're in China and they're privy to versions of those traditions who have not perhaps reached their historical destiny. Does this make sense to you, according to this scheme? Okay. Well, last text, same story, but even more pronounced. This is the French translation and really an elaboration of Nanjo's text on the 12 sects. And it's quite explicit. It's written by a man named Fujishima Ryoen, and he himself was a Jodo Shinshu priest who had visited and studied in France, and he rewrote this text and produces a very, very clear story. He represents Jodo Shinshu, his tradition, at the end of this narrative, represents the final predestined unfolding of the Buddhist teaching, and it renders obsolete all other earlier Buddhist schools and teachings subordinated to. It's a religion of national faith, spirituality, and morality. Buddhism disappeared long ago in India, was once vital in China, but since has become corrupted and entered into decline. And only in Japan has Buddhism continuously flourished and reached its culmination. Okay? So only to Japan can we assign the name true or orthodox Buddhism. So you can see the tensions emerging among different Buddhist parties here. This discourse takes hold in this age. Chinese obviously reacted with dismay. It ended the friendship of Yan Wenwei and Nanjo Bunyu unnaturally. Yan Wenwei writes in the preface about the Hashu Koyo. I love this passage. He says, if you read this, he says to students, when students wade into this text, meaning Hashu Koyo, with its very particular narrative scenario, and begin to make comparisons, they should take care not to enter as Lord and Master and exit as slave. So he's really reacting and responding to what he sees as an aggressive hegemonic discourse in his text. Ding Fubao who wrote a preface to Yang, a very famous scholar in China, wrote a preface to Yang's text for beginning students. The teachings of Dharma holistically interfuse with one another, and in their interfusion, they are collectively sublime, and people are given to bias grasping, and through bias grasping, the teachings become mutually conflicting. The problem arises from the inability to integrate the different schools, which causes them to become as mutually repellent as fire and water, you know. So there's a real resistance to in Chinese mindset at this period. And probably now historians show us that this synthetic or kind of holistic style of thinking about the variant Buddhist doctrines and teachings and texts, that discourse of kind of harmonious interfusion is actively present in intellectual culture and Buddhism in China probably as early as 15th and 16th century. So it's very much established part of the Buddhist landscape in China. And so clearly they're very much, you know, sensitive to and in opposition to the strict linear historical development and sectarian differentiation that's found among the Japanese version. So last person says, each school, for the most part, denigrates other schools and lauds the superiority of its own. For beginning students, this is very problematic. So they don't like the message that's being sent, okay? So Yang Wenhui basically, in his texts, completely turns the narrative around. He's again listing 10 sects or so, but he's positioning them differently and giving them a different narrative flow, okay? So he places first the Vinaya school or teaching and places Pure Land last, as Japanese had done. But there's a major difference here. What this is set up for is a soteriological path or narrative. And the emphasis is on integral complementarity of the 10 schools, right? So he says, the foregoing 9 schools, prior to the last one, Pure Land, individually accommodate the myriad capacities, the different cultural backgrounds and capacities and abilities and inclinations of different human beings, okay? Capacities. Regardless of the particular teaching that one pursues, Hinayana, Mahayana, different versions of the Mahayana, India, China, Japan, so it's regardless of the particular teaching, they all serve as provisions for rebirth in the Pure Land. You know, this destiny of rebirth in the spiritual paradise after death, where anyone can go via these teachings. Okay? As such, the 9 schools enter into this one culminating school or end of the Pure Land. And upon rebirth in the Pure Land, each and every teaching of Dharma is apprehended in its integral totality. So even Pure Land disappears once you enter Pure Land because you've apprehended the sort of universal, unchanging message and truth of the Buddha himself. Okay. Thus, the one school or teaching of the Pure Land enters the 9 and they interfuse without obstruction. It's a very, very different interfusing holistic model from this historically progressive and evolutionary one of the other texts. Now, this is just a little footnote to the relationship between Yang Wenhui and the Jodo Shinshu in Japan that brings home just how serious some of these distinctions were. In 1875, the Jodo Shinshu, bent on its modernizing, universalizing, missionizing, you know, message, initiates a mission in Shanghai which was led by Oberusu Kocho, one of the very men who wrote one of the sweeping texts I mentioned earlier. He's also a man who had become a personal friend of Yang Wenhui and knew Nanzhou Bunyu quite well. In 1876, Oberusu writes a text called Basics of Shinshu Teaching in Chinese, which he circulates to potential Chinese converts. It's a really interesting text. He also befriends Nanzhou Bunyu in 1878 and 84. They arrange for copies of lost Chinese texts to be introduced to Japan, or reintroduced from Japan back to China. Now, among those lost texts was a commentary by a Chinese master known as Shandao, who lived in the 8th century, to an important Pure Land Sutra. That text had been lost fairly early in China, but had a major impact in Japan. and was the, probably one of the seminal texts from which Pure Land and Jodo Shinshu traditions found theological basis and evolved. Are you following my reasoning here? It's a Chinese text by a Chinese master that ends up in Japan, and it paves the way and is a holy text of the Jodo Shinshu, okay? But long gone from Japan, China, which could only also signal that, you know, Chinese Buddhist traditions had gone to pot by this time and were in decline. When Chinese get this text and reread it, they see a completely different message in it from the one that's promulgated by the, an interpretation from the one promulgated by the Jodo Shinshu, and especially from the one promulgated in Ogurusu's short missionizing tract he wrote. Controversies erupt between Chinese Buddhists and Japanese Shinshu priests over the interpretation of Shandao's teaching. Right at the same time, the Jodo Shinshu mission had by this time already subsumed some 30 Buddhist monasteries in China that had fallen on decline and turned them into Jodo Shinshu institutions. So there's a bit of alarm among Buddhists during this period. This is the same period where we're beginning to see the government seizing Buddhist properties in China as well. So a Shinshu mission is then established in Nanjing, which was Yang Honghui's own town. Okay? And open ideological conflict develops between the two, and that's pretty much the end of it. All right? They part ways, and that's it. But going back to Yang's interesting model of the, this interfusing world of Buddhist teachings and traditions, right? That he sees culminating this image of a pure land that is inclusive of all messages and culminating of all messages, very different from, and is largely timeless and geared to the idea of capacity and synthesis. Remember also that he was a man struggling to revive Buddhism in his period, a man struggling to come to grips with the institutional social changes that were taking place, was bent on popularizing and modernizing Buddhism in the image of Western universities and institutions to bring it into the modern age. So he's just as much driven by that goal as others. So I'd like to just finish with this rather amusing passage in which he gives us his updated modern representation of the Pure Land as he sees it. And bear in mind that this is the model, probably a representation, that may well have influenced Shengyan's own drive and ambition to build a Buddhist university in Taiwan, really the first of its kind, as well as to teach Westerners such as myself and establish centers in the United States, and to seek academic education himself. Yang says, among persons today who are intellectually discerning, there are none who do not give utmost importance to places of learning. To borrow the simile, the Western Pure Land is simply the epitome of universities. That's the metaphor for him. Amitabha greets and draws living beings there from every direction so they can pursue study. He supplies them with meals and clothing. Tuition is not required. Take note. Nor does he set a quota on the number of students admitted or their age. The grounds and facilities of the campus are themselves of unfathomable size, and if you're a constrained property university, you'll understand what that means. Their dimensions utterly without limit. Persons who enter his school, regardless of their ability, eventually achieve the assurance of the unoriginated nature of the Dharma, Shanti, that is, the highest realization that births the wisdom of a Buddha or Buddhahood, you know, on the Bodhisattva path. It's the watershed experience of guaranteed future Buddhahood. And to put it in the most absolute terms possible, all the manifold teachings of the 10 directions and 3 periods are replete there without exception. Hence, among all the Buddhas, there is none, not one who does not sing its praises. So there you have it, you know. The taking of this ancient, archaic idea of rebirth in Amitabha's Western Pure Land and re-envisioning that in the image of a, you know, modern university, but one that is freed of all its limitations of capacity and size and inability to teach. So transforming the world, even free of you know, geographical location and limits. Okay. So that's the end of my talk. This brings us back to Master Shengyan, and just out of courtesy of him, this is a shot up above of his diploma from the Buddhist Academy at Jing'an Monastery, Shanghai, where he might have read this very passage. And this is his class graduation photo from 1948. So, thank you, folks.
If anyone have questions, we can entertain a few questions before we conclude. I was fascinated by Yang Wenhui's 12 sects, that chart. It doesn't have Chan.
Doesn't it?
And
maybe not. I wonder why.
Of course, the TV logical ending is different. One, the previous two ending in Japan, Gyonen and Nanju Bumyo, and Yang Wenhui is ending in China.
That's interesting.
So you have the three texts side by side. The one before this. But even in that one, here you see Yang Wenhui's text in China. And then the next slide.
It'd be interesting to go back and see that.
The next sect.
The next slide has them, doesn't it?
Doesn't have the. China. Oh, I see it.
It's there.
Number
it's,
eight.
It's just hard to see. It's number eight. And it has Shingon and it has Jyotoshu, but it doesn't have Nichiren. Which would make sense. I mean, it doesn't go that far. That's an interesting distinction. I hadn't really thought about it. Yeah, Brian.
Go back to the other slide, behind this one.
Behind this one?
Previous there.
Yeah.
The I'm just curious historiographically, the structures of these texts. Gyoen's text. There's no cosmology in that beginning?
I have to go back and look. You know, there is a sort, but from what I recall offhand, it's been a while since I've looked at it, it's really a discussion about the relationship of expediency to reality and the relationship of expediency and reality to capacity. You know, human ability is the functional basis on which those distinctions of expediency are made, you know? So time is sort of subsumed into that as well. And I don't think there's discussion of cosmology in terms of the six realms of rebirth, you know, the supramundane.
Well, is that what's going on?
That's what's going on in some of the others, as a basic layout.
They don't take it even further back.
Yeah.
The kind of more cosmic time.
Yeah, and you know, Buddha lands elsewhere, some other things like that as well. Yeah, and also, you know, prior Buddhas and so forth, you know. So it's a little more, as I recall, it's more emphasis into that. There are some other aspects of Gyoen's text that are kind of interesting as well, but you know, I just didn't dwell on them for sake of brevity.
And you had mentioned on his text that it began to get printed
in 1800s. When it started to get reprinted again,
curious about the history of the manuscript itself of Gyoen's text.
Yeah.
Was it just the manuscript tradition, or you just have Gyoen's?
Seems to largely have been a manuscript tradition, but there clearly
never been printed.
No, there was a printing. There clearly was one, maybe two printings, as I recall, in the 1600s. You know, and there's not much evidence of impact there, you know, or whether just the documentary record is lost now. Don't know. You know, but it's maybe just that one shot. You know, for 300 years, not much manuscript tradition, of which a few exemplars exist, not many. You know, and who found it, rediscovered it, is a question I'd love to know more about. You know,
and whether or not this structure, this kind of historiographical framework of a text, is unique to Gyoen.
No, I mean, he wrote another text that also is a kind of just largely a history across three continents, you know, of India, China, and Japan. We'd have to go back, and I can't really answer in all honesty. I'm not that familiar with this, you know, with the literatures of this period of you know, in Buddhist circles in Japan. There's always been an awareness, even from the very beginning of Buddhism in China, that of transmission from an earlier period. Buddha in India, issues of authenticity and legitimacy. So, you know, that narrative sweep has been part of its historical imagination from the moment it arrived in East Asia. And certain works got produced in China on that basis, you know, certain works got produced in Japan. Yeah. So it's there, you know. Yeah. Yes?
So, it's very interesting to see all the jockeying going on.
Oh, yeah, I thought so too.
And
yeah.
What is it like now, several generations later, with the relationship between the Japanese Buddhists and the Chinese?
A lot of it depends on who you talk to. And there are some issues on which they're fine, you know. I mean, and Sheng Yan himself was a great example of having spent a considerable time in Japan, becoming great friends with Japanese scholars and so forth. There are some messages you sort of steer away from. In Japan, there's been a lot of sort of revisionist thinking about the impact of this sort of narrative, particularly in the war years and afterwards, you know, as kind of feeding into Japanese militarism and being complicit in that in some regards. And among Buddhists, and I've known quite a few who have themselves talked about that, and some traditions more than others have really made that a major point of discussion. And I think things are much more relaxed now than they were some, you know, decades earlier. Yeah. But this was a particularly tense period. Right? Yeah. This makes sense. I always worry it's like totally overwhelming, you know, because I look at it myself, I go, oh my God, how am I going to survive this? But
it's great. All right. Thank you.